Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Today we're going to consider yet another overlooked aspect of relational reality, by which I mean the fact that all physical reality, including humans, is way, way more dynamically interrelated than modernity has assumed. And specifically, we'll be looking today at the interrelated dynamics of people within the built environment, particularly the way we experience being in urban or semi-urban settings. Now, there are two problems in our received heritage that have caused the fact that we have a dynamically interrelated exchange with our environment to be missed, to be not noticed for hundreds of years. And one, of course, was the idea in the West from the time of the classical Greeks that there's a discontinuity, a radical break between self and the rest of the world. So we, as modern people, generally assume to be bags of skin, autonomous little bags of skin moving around. And of course, what was needed in planning cities was just the very efficient, rationalist way of laying them out. But any kind of rational thinking is a limiting of the gestalt. You necessarily pick certain things out of the huge, vast, dynamic, complex, interrelated, pulsing gestalt to pay attention to and call that what's rational in your society. So in the West, the build-out, or later urban renewal in our cities, adhered to modernity's premise that an advanced society lives apart from nature and largely on top of it. And so what seemed rational was to cluster buildings in a rigid grid pattern of city streets, bereft, really, of any trees or other botanical life in most cases. And until recently, walking through a modern city was, and still is in many, many places, I would say a harsh experience in a sterile habitat. It's true that humans have become accustomed to it, but at what inner cost? So one aspect of the new thinking about urban design is the realization that we have been building and dwelling in wrong relationship with nature. And in re-engaging with the rest of the natural world so as to leave a smaller footprint of ecological damage, to restore and enhance the habitats of our species and other species, and to really ecologize our thinking in every area so that we see the dynamic interrelatedness, we experience an unexpected benefit if we do that, and that is that we become collectively healed of the corrosive, distorting effects of a modernity that had cut us off from the web of life. Now, the other main element in relational thinking about urban design is new attention to the matter of the actual relational needs of human beings in their communities and dwellings. When our country was born in the 18th century, urban design and land use planning, it was strongly influenced by the aesthetic of the day, which was neoclassical geometrics. So the neoclassical grid, which in its original form as the classical grid pattern, it was prized by the Roman Empire for the efficient standardization and control it made possible. And the grid layout of cities has some benefits, of course. It allows us to find our way around easily, follow directions, or that's become simple. But it imposes a geometric template onto the urban area that bears no relation to landforms, hills, rivers, or the organic integrity of place. And the other big problem with the grid layout of most of our cities is that the sort of neighborhood places for gathering and visiting that develop naturally in non-grid cities are generally missing in grid cities. And to compound that problem, the design aesthetic that guided what became called urban renewal projects after World War II, was yet another burst, an intensified burst, really, of geometric reductionist, disciplined, so to speak, as they claimed, mentality, this time guided by the ideal of Le Corbusier's rationalist radiant city plan, which called for superhighways and close groupings of high-rise apartment buildings, or projects, as we call them, separated by space that soon became a wasteland. And to the high-minded modernist urban renewal movement, the organic relational connections of community that nurtured the residents of the inner city counted for nothing. Those haphazard meeting spots and walkways through yards were seen merely as unmodern untidiness that had to be replaced. But I want to emphasize, it was not the case that the urban planners who gutted our cities and the architects who designed the high-rise projects hated nature or cared little about the relational needs of people who would occupy their buildings. It was just that their intensely modern education had emphasized the rational application of abstract ideas and geometric forms with efficiency and a highly constrained sense of logic as their disciplining guides. But unfortunately, the so-called tough-minded, and I would say narrowly conceived, rational design process prized during the post-war period placed people and nature off to the side somewhere as largely peripheral abstractions. It's really only in recent decades, and particularly with great advances in recent years, that a grand correction to this mechanistic orientation in urban planning and community design has emerged. Our focus on the program today will not be specific buildings or urban planning, but rather the emergence of ways to think about the multivalent ways in which actual humans are affected by the built environment around them. My guests today, David Simon and Mindy Fullilove, have each done pioneering work in this hugely significant area. I mentioned the work of each of them in my book last year, Relational Reality, and so I'm really thrilled to have them on today so that we can hear more about their insightful contributions. David Simon is an environment-behavior researcher. He holds a PhD in geography and is a professor of architecture at Kansas State University. His research and writings focus on the ways that the natural and built environments contribute to human well-being. David Simon's books include A Geography of the Life World, and then an anthology he co-edited, Dwelling, Place, and Environment, which is where I first connected with his ideas. That was 1985, a very important book. And then he wrote Dwelling, Seeing, and Designing. And then he co-edited an anthology, Goethe's Way of Science, A Phenomenology of Nature. And perhaps most importantly, he edits this really great little journal, which I am always so happy to see in my mailbox because everything in it is fascinating. It's called Environmental and Architectural Phenomenology Newsletter. He calls it a newsletter. It's either a long newsletter with significant articles, or I think of it as a short journal. Anyway, this year began the 23rd year of publication of EAP, Environmental and Architectural Phenomenology Newsletter. And he's speaking with us today from his office at Kansas State University. Now, it was while reading that journal, EAP, EAP, that I learned about the work of my next guest. Mindy Thompson Fullilove, MD, is a board-certified psychiatrist and a research psychiatrist at New York State Psychiatric Institute. She's also a professor of clinical psychiatry and public health at Columbia University. She's conducted research on AIDS and other epidemics of poor communities with a special interest in the relationship between the collapse of communities and the decline in health. From her research, she has published the book, Root Shock, How Tearing Up City Neighborhoods Hurts America and What We Can Do About It. And another book entitled The House of Joshua, Meditations on Family and Place. She's also published numerous articles, book chapters, monographs, and she has a new book coming out in about 6 months entitled Urban Alchemy, Restoring Joy in America's Fractured Cities. She's speaking with us from her office at Columbia University. David Simon and Mindy Full of Love, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'd like to begin with David because I think your work provides a broad frame of reference for ways of thinking about how people experience place and buildings and the entire built environment. And I see that you're a geographer in the Department of Architecture, which is unusual. So how did that come about?
Yes, it does seem unusual that somebody trained in geography might end up in a Department of Architecture. I did my graduate work at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts in the early 1970s. And at Clark University, the two largest programs were geography and psychology. And during the 1970s, there was an effort to create an interdisciplinary graduate program, which the psychologists called environmental psychology, and the geographers would call behavioral geography or psychogeography. And it was out of that graduate program that I became interested in the ways that the material, the physical, the geographical, the architectural, the designed environments relate to human behavior and experience. And in that program, as fellow graduate students, there were quite a number of designers, architects and landscape architects mostly. So very early on, I recognized that perhaps one of the most useful understandings practically that could come out of this interdisciplinary effort, what eventually came to be called environment behavior research, is the fact that the designed environment plays a major role in human life. So, for example, if your boss constructs a new office building and you have an office in that building and that office doesn't work well, you're going to have to put up with that for quite a long time because obviously we can't build a new building every other week. So the physical environment, the material environment, the spatial environment, the designable environment is such an integral part of human life. And eventually I became more and more involved with the designers, and that's essentially how I ended up with my architect colleagues here at Kansas State, who are a wonderful group of people in the sense that they're open to non-designer points of view on design issues.
What does that
now,
mean?
Now, of course, the other issue you we might
want
to get into...
Wait, David, what does that mean, non-designer issues?
Well, in the sense that I'm not a designer per se. I offer advice on how to design, but I don't claim to be a designer. And, of course, being a designer...
Oh, I see, sort of contextual issues?
Yes, yes. So, for example, getting my students, if they're designing housing for the elderly, for example, to think about what the world of the older person is like and what sorts of needs should be included in those dwellings. So, for example, you probably don't want to include walk-ups in your design because typically older people are less mobile. They can have accidents, and if they break their leg, obviously they're going to be out of activity for several weeks. So how could they live in an apartment or a home that's multi-level that becomes a difficulty?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a wide range of research in environment behavior research, and one individual I might mention who any listeners who would like to look into this field, I recommend they take a look at is urban researcher William White's work, which was a very early important contribution to environment behavior research. And William White was hired by the city officials of New York back in the 70s to figure out why plazas, which were being built at the time, and they were being built because developers in New York were given bonuses. They could build higher structures. They could increase their square footage if they provided a public plaza at the base of the building. And what the New York officials noticed is that many of these plazas were not being used, or they were underused. That is, there were rarely any people in them. So the question became, what was happening? Why weren't these plazas working? And William White created a research group, and he and his researchers would go out, and essentially they would observe plaza behavior. So they would see how many people were using a plaza at a particular time. They would see, they would look at who was sitting where. And they would also do what is called time-lapse photography. That is, they would set a camera looking down on the plaza, and then they would take an image every few seconds. And out of that, you get a kind of slow-motion picture of how the space is used over time. And what they discovered out of this research is that there are three major factors which determine whether a plaza is going to be used or not. The first of which, as one might guess, is location. That is, the plaza needs to be near potential users. There's that old Kevin Costner movie you may remember, Field of Dreams, where the voice says, if you build it, they will come.
Yeah.
No, not for a plaza. People will only come if it's conveniently located. And typically, White found that most pedestrian users are not willing to go more than three blocks out of their way to use a plaza. So first of all, you've got to think about location, placing the plaza near a potential user pool. And then once you've got a good location, you want to think about the plaza's relationship with the street. White said, what you want to do is generate impulse use. In other words, you're walking by, you've got 10 minutes to spare, you look into this lovely plaza, there's a kiosk there selling coffee, there's tables and chairs under a grove of trees. So before you know it, you've walked into the plaza, you're sitting at a table having your coffee. This is what he called impulse use. And he said there are quite a number of design factors which contribute to impulse use. First of all, you don't want a plaza that's too low or too high. So sunken plazas are not good. Elevated plazas are not good. You want a smooth continuity, design-wise, between the sidewalk and the plaza. In fact, the best plaza designs, it's hard to tell where the sidewalk ends and the plaza begins. This is what I call the vacuum cleaner model. The plaza sucks people in, and they aren't even aware of it. And then William White said, you know, once you've got people in the plaza, you want to keep them there. And the easiest way to do that in terms of design is by providing lots of sitting. And sitting involves both physical comfort and social comfort. So you don't want benches, for example, that are too low or are too high. So you don't want a bench that's lower than 12 inches, which is what, about a third of a meter. You don't want that because if you're an older person, you get down on a low seat and you can't get back up. Also, you don't want seats that are too high. So you don't want seats typically higher than 36 inches, which is a little less than a meter. And you also want social comfort, the idea that you want a range of seating possibilities. So you can sit alone and study. You can sit with your significant other and make out. Or you can sit with a group of your colleagues and work out a problem from the office. But the point is there is a range of sitting possibilities. And these were the three most important factors. And what William White discovered is that many of the New York City plazas failed in all three factors. On the other hand, there were wonderfully successful plazas. For example, one good example would be Paley Park or Greenacre Park in New York City, or a park which used to be a terrible failure, Bryant Park, near the main branch of the New York City Library. That has been rehabbed on the basis of White's principles, and of course today is one of the most significant social spaces in the city. Now, I could go on, but I hope that gives your...
Well, I just wanted to tell the listeners, if they look up William White online, it's spelled with a Y, W-H-Y-T-E. And I'm wondering, as I listen to you talk, of what happened in more recent years. Not the greening. I mean, hats off to Mayor Bloomberg and the city of New York. They're greening a lot of their pocket parks, I read about. But in several cities, I'm thinking of Union Square in San Francisco, they had a competition for it. What seems to be the fad now in landscape design is to put those big slabs of marble or granite in. It's very geometric. There aren't many trees or plants, and, you know, I guess it's low maintenance, but I see that over and over again. Instead of learning about how trees or plants might function in a space, just put in this long geometric slab, sink it into a lawn, and that's that. It seems really unalluring, unlike the grove of trees that William White describes.
Well, yes.
Have you noticed that?
Of course, part of the issue here is that environmental design, landscape architecture, they're very much creatures of fashion. And it is interesting how when I began my academic career in the 1980s, this approach I'm talking about, the environment behavior approach, was quite powerful in the design professions. But by the end of the 1980s, the whole postmodern, post-structural approach had moved into dominance. And of course, today, the big emphasis in so much environmental design is appearance only, particularly edgy appearance.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the deconstructionist architecture associated with somebody like Frank Gehry or Daniel Libeskind, these are buildings which intentionally try to create surprise and shock. So the many of these buildings, you know, a layperson looks at them and wonders how they continue to stand up because they look like they're exploding or ready to fall down. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that somehow bad or wrong, but much of this recent work is largely grounded in visual appearance only. And there is a strong movement in what's called the phenomenological tradition, people like Juhani Palasma, who's a Finnish architect, and argues that one of the great failures of modernist architecture was that it was mostly visual only. And we have to find ways to move toward design, which is multidimensional in terms of sensuousness.
So well, yeah, that's the point.
That
I mean, to me, they're not visually alluring at all. They're ugly because they're missing nature, you know. And there used to be trees there, and then they took them out to make these new designs. So I don't think they can even argue that, oh, well, we've gone with the visual, you know, unless you have an aesthetic bereft of any appreciation of nature. That's not a beautiful design. Anyway, I'm happy to learn what you just said about the answer to my wondering why these big geometric slabs came in, but I want to make sure we allow enough time for this big project that you oversee, which is the wonderful journal, or as you call it, newsletter, Environmental and Architectural Phenomenology. And I wonder if you could tell us about that, give us an overview of it, although there's so much richness to it, I can just skim the surface. And I think you need to begin with explaining what phenomenology is and why you were drawn to it.
Yes, and this is a very important point because my approach to environment behavior research is fairly different from many mainstream researchers who were trained in a much more scientific, quantitative, positivist tradition. And this is, of course, one place where your work and my work overlaps, because both of us are so interested in relationality in the world. And, of course, phenomenology is interested in what might be called lived relationality. Now, let me explain that more carefully. First of all, the word phenomenology. Now, I realize for many listeners this word sounds very dense. And I feel phenomenology should become a household word. I think it's one of the most remarkable ways of seeing that we have in our Western world. Now, what is phenomenology? Well, most directly, the word phenomenology means the study of phenomena. Now, as we use the word phenomena, we're talking about things or experiences as experienced. So there can be a phenomenology of home and at homeness. There can be a phenomenology of architecture. There can be a phenomenology of the weather. There can be a phenomenology of community. And so much of Mindy's work is related to that topic and how community collapses when the physical web of the community is undermined or destroyed. But the key point about phenomenology is that it is interested in describing and interpreting human experience. And there are a number of important concepts in phenomenology which I think are quite remarkable and led me to become interested in this philosophical tradition. Now, one of these phenomenological concepts is life world. The life world is the everyday world of taken-for-grantedness. And this is what is so interesting about the life world. It simply unfolds most of the time, and we don't have to do anything for it to be so. Most of the time, we're not aware of the life world. Now, when there's some kind of change in the life world, let's say, for example, our neighborhood is destroyed by a tornado, for example, then suddenly you realize what your world was and how that world has been totally disrupted by this storm destruction. But most of the time, the life world is transparent. It's the world of taken-for-grantedness. And one aim of phenomenological investigation is to find ways to describe explicitly, academically, the life world. Now, the other side of the coin in terms of life world is what is called the natural attitude. And this is the fact that we take for granted the life world. This is the natural attitude. And one aim of phenomenological research is to move from the natural attitude to what is called the phenomenological attitude. In other words, finding ways to make the taken-for-grantedness of daily life visible.
So you could say it's a paying attention to the way it feels, the way it feels to be in a room, the way it feels to be in a family, and with very specific focuses, right?
Yes, I don't think we should start with feeling. You know, we don't want to turn this into some kind of mystical occult.
Well, I guess I'm thinking in a Whiteheadian way. We feel, we prehend what's around us.
We do, but of course, in the phenomenological tradition, one very important emphasis is what is called the lived body, the fact that we are embodied in the world. And this is a topic I'm very much interested in, how the so-called body subject, as the French phenomenological philosopher Maurice Merleau-Ponty calls it, how the body subject plays such a key role in daily life. In other words, the power of habit, the fact that so much of people's everyday lives are grounded in routine and regularity. And you see, this is not so much feeling. This is the realm of the body just doing its thing and unfolding in terms of routines, tasks, behaviors, actions in the daily world.
Uh-huh.
Now, you can get into the whole question of feeling, and here, for example, my research, much of it deals with people's attachment to place.
Hold on, David. We need to stop here for the break and come back, and we'll pick up there, and maybe you can give a little overview of the journal, and then we'll move on to speaking with Mindy. But before I pause here for the break, I want to give the website address for this newsletter, because you won't be able to find it very easily by Googling EAP. A lot of other things come up. So it's ARC, as in architecture, ARC.ksu.edu/CEAMON, /EAP. I'll give that again later. But let's pause now for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guests, David CEAMON and Mindy Fullilove, on All Together Now. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guests, David CEAMON and Mindy Fullilove. Again, the website for the publication David edits, Environmental and Architectural Phenomenology, is arc.ksu.edu/CEAMON/EAP. So, David, briefly, could you give the listeners an overview of this publication? Because I do want to have time to talk with Mindy Fullilove here.
Yes, certainly. This journal is published 3 times a year, and it's largely serendipitous. Contributors send me pieces, and I publish them, and all of the material is looking at various environmental and architectural dimensions of well-being. So, for example, the spring issue, 2012, focuses on the theme of home and at-homeness. And so the first issue, the first article in the issue is this heartrending, I think, essay by interior designer Jane Berry, who describes the house that her dad has lived in for 65 years and the difficulties he has in terms of mobility, in terms of dealing with that house in the last several months of his life. So, for example, he's no longer very flexible in terms of movement, so he can't bend over to plug in an appliance because the plug-in is too low on the wall. He has troubles grasping, so he can't open his glass jar where he stores the oatmeal. These are very simple life-world events, and yet in this essay, Jane Berry demonstrates how they join together to create a very difficult situation for her dad. And it was out of this experience partly that Jane Berry became interested in aging in place. In other words, she works with older people and helps them modify their homes so that they can continue to live in those houses even as they become more feeble. And then the other essay in this issue is by a health sociologist and a nursing professor. And these two individuals are doing research on assistive technology in homes. Now, assistive technology would be something like a breathing machine. And these homes have children who have to have assistive technology. The child will die, for example, if the breathing machine is not there. So they're very interested in how this technology disrupts the home environment and what practitioners might do in relation to it. So very often we focus on a particular topic like home and at-homeness, or it might be environmental encounter. It might be sustainability as lived. It might be architectural experience. These are the kinds of topics we try to cover in the newsletter.
Uh-huh.
And that's why we covered Mindy's work quite a number of years ago when Root Shock came out, because I thought it was such a remarkable account of how the disruption of the urban fabric, the street structure, the neighborhood structure, the buildings, could totally upset the lifeways of groups of people. It's really a remarkable.
I totally agree.
Presentation.
And Mindy Fololove, I want to say it's not only that you turned to something that had been, as they say, understudied, under-theorized in American society, but you had such beautifully expressed insights. So I'm going to ask you to speak about Root Shock, and especially your concept of a field of kindness, which I think is such a great metaphor to get across the dynamic interrelatedness that's in play all the time within this particular field. I just want to say first that this interdisciplinary area you've helped to create, I'm sure one of many, but merging psychiatry and public health, it's very interesting. I read yesterday that the illness now, affliction around the world with the greatest number of people is depression. And so it's the biggest public health problem. This is particularly in post-war societies. But I just think you've helped to create something that's just so key for things we need to figure out now. But let's turn to Root Shock. Can you, would you tell the listeners what you mean by that?
Certainly. I was looking at neighborhoods that had been destroyed by 1950s and 1960s urban renewal projects, when very large areas of cities were bulldozed, so maybe 100 acres, 150 acres, and the whole neighborhood, all the people who lived there, all the businesses, all the organizations were dispersed. And I wanted to know what that was like for people, so I went with my colleagues and I went to five different American cities where this had happened and talked to people who lived in the neighborhoods, people who'd been planners for the projects, and advocates who'd been watching the projects as they happened. And out of this, really, we tried to describe this idea of root shock. So we took that term from gardeners who have described that if you yank a plant out of the ground, it will go into shock. Mm-hmm. And if you've badly torn the root system, you won't be able to retransplant it safely. It will die. And so we thought this very rude moving people out of their neighborhoods really created a state of shock for the individuals and for the community that were in these places. And along the way, we defined root shock as the traumatic stress reaction to losing all or part of one's emotional ecosystem. So that was the emotional ecosystem was our way of saying the life world.
Uh-huh.
There's another term that we use that we like very much, which is May's way, a term proposed by anthropologist Anthony F.C. Wallace, meaning that all the ideas, the complex set of ideas we have for how we live in the world, whatever term you use, as David explained so well, we don't pay much attention to the world as we live in it until it's stripped away from us. And so as a psychiatrist, that's why I wanted to study neighborhoods that had been destroyed, because I thought it really allowed us to see what does the world mean. It's in those you might say liminal moments when the world is lost that people are like, oh, I get what it means to me. So that's what drew our attention.
Uh-huh. When I heard about your work, I also was reminded of another template that's underneath that. I mean, you talk about this disruption when people were yanked out of their neighborhoods and they were leveled in order for the projects, big apartment buildings to put up, or not. I mean, some spaces were just left empty because, you know, President Nixon came into office and sort of declared victory on urban renewal and cut the money off. So for a lot of places, they just stayed barren in the middle of cities for decades. But what I was thinking of was the fact that I've been told by African-American friends and acquaintances, when they describe what their family went through in generations, in whichever wave of the Great Migration they were in when they came up from the land, from being farmers in the South to take the industrial jobs in the North. And, of course, that was like instantly stepping into modernity. It was very shocking. It was the same kind of shock that immigrants from Europe and Latin America and Asia have gotten when they come over on a boat or however, and instantly are moving from an agrarian culture into modernity. And, you know, generally the first generation is in shock for about 40 years, and the second generation works very hard to assimilate and be modern Americans. And the third generation, the grandchildren start asking the grandparents, well, what was it like back on the farm? What kind of trees were there? What kind of plants were around there? What was it like to live on the land? And so they're curious about what's been lost. So anyway, I see a lot of African-American families as being just partway through that wrenching process, and then comes post-war urban renewal, and it's another wrenching them out of where they are. It's like a second root shock, I think. What would you think of that?
You know, one of the places where that gets commented on is in the famous Kerner Commission report, which I'm sure you'll remember was the report that was done after the massive riots in 1967. And they talk about how about exactly that, people coming especially from rural areas and the difference between moving to a city from a rural area and moving to a city from another city and the generational process that you've described. So they had exactly that lens on all the riots of the 1960s, which occur at the end of the 60s, right after really two decades of urban renewal, which is a direct precipitant of the riots.
Right.
So I think scholars who've looked closely at that would tend to agree with you that people had not yet quite adjusted to city life before they had lost their neighborhoods.
Yeah. Now, what about your concept of field of kindness? Can you talk about that?
And I don't know that I meant it as a concept so much as a description.
Okay. Okay, you're observing something that exists.
Exactly. That I was just sort of trying to say what it sounded like people were trying to describe to me. I had a chance to interview many people and to spend a lot of time with one man, David Jenkins, who had grown up in a neighborhood in southeast Philadelphia and who was 11 years old when they destroyed his neighborhood, but who had the most vivid memories of what it was like to really be a kid and be embraced and cared for by this net of men and women who gave him flowers and gave him dinner and rejoiced in his talents and had plans for his future. And was really from him that I just got this idea of this field of kindness. And probably the specific word was because we went to visit his neighborhood, and it was one of those that you mentioned where nothing had been built, although it wasn't because of President Nixon. And it was a field, so literally there was this quite startling field where his home had been. So the point is that these are neighborhoods that were considered to be a cancer on American society, but the people who lived in them were trying to say, no, this was this net of generosity and mutual concern and reciprocity that made life worth living and rich and fun. So it was quite the opposite from how it was portrayed and the justification for destroying it. That's why it was so important for me to say that. In the same way that Jane Jacobs, in trying to talk about why we have to protect cities, talks about sidewalk life as the sidewalk ballet, because it's, you know, like criminals on the sidewalks of the city, and she was like, no, this is a ballet that's going on here.
Uh-huh. Now, having diagnosed this problem, many problems involved, I see your forthcoming book is on sort of what we can do about this, Urban Alchemy, Restoring Joy in America's Fractured Cities. This will be out in February. What do you mean, really, by urban alchemy?
I've been watching quite a number of neighborhoods and studying with urbanists who have been, you know, have various strategies for how you restore neighborhoods that have been the victims of terrible, terrible policies of disinvestment. And to some extent, what happens is, you know, you sort of, in an orderly and very kind way, part of that field of kindness, put back buildings and fix streets and plant trees and celebrate people's history. But then something magical happens, which is that the thing starts to live again in a very positive way. And that's what I mean by urban alchemy, is that accumulation of small changes that suddenly burst into new life.
Uh-huh. Some examples?
You know, I think one of the most interesting examples, which is really in many American cities, is that with the outbreak of the crack epidemic in the middle of the 1980s to the middle of the 1990s, there's terrible violence everywhere. And all kinds of people began to organize to do things about it. A lot of this was very informal. There was a woman in Washington Heights that we interviewed who just decided she would plant flowers alongside a staircase. That was her contribution to fighting the violence epidemic. There were hundreds or thousands of these small contributions that we knew about. And they grew over, you know, as the violence epidemic was growing, these anti-violence things were growing. And then finally they got to be big enough and the violence epidemic was suppressed. Now, usually people say, oh, it was because there was, you know, new kinds of policing. But in our neighborhood, the neighborhood where I work, was certainly a part of it. But these quiet things that individuals did to restore their place were huge, hugely important in remaking peace. But it's magical how all of a sudden, like, the violence was there and then it wasn't. It was magical.
Interesting. Well, that almost seems like it's an ecological counterpoint of the field of caring you described in the first book, Root Shock, because, you know, as I remember, you were making the point that there was a palpable sense of community. And so if, you know, young teenagers walking along this pathway and an older man says, you know, where are you going with that pack of cigarettes, son? The boy feels the whole community, you know, setting protective boundaries for him. I mean, at the moment, he might feel thwarted, but that there's this field of caring, as you put it. And so it almost seems as if planting the flowers was another way to create a field that people felt embedded in. So I don't know. That's just one possibility. But
yeah, no, I think that people do many things to actually literally create a sense of a field, picking up garbage and planting trees and planting flowers, or painting their stairs, or saying hello. There's a whole reclaiming of space,
right?
Which is not simply about nature, because it's not like weeds. It's not like letting weeds grow would give that message.
Right.
So it's about concern.
Environmental. Well, we have to mention here the city repair movement, which has done very interesting work with grassroots transforming of intersections into plazas for neighborhoods and how depression goes down in the neighborhood and health goes up. Well, I'll have some people on from the city repair movement in the future. But I want to thank both of you, David Simon and Mindy Fullilove, so much for being on All Together today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to move over into the arts corner as we do, stretch our minds beyond mechanistic schooling. And let's see, the poem we have today is about place. And to balance the fact that we've been speaking mostly about urban or even semi-urban places, this poem is about deeply inhabiting a rural place, having that as your formative experience. The poem is Being Country Bred by Mary Oliver. It's from the book of poems entitled New and Selected Poems, Volume 1, by Mary Oliver. Being country bred, I am at ease in darkness. Like everything that thrives in fields beyond the city's keep, I own 5 wooden senses and a 6th like water. These things I know before they set their mark upon the earth. Chinook and snow, mornings of frost in the well, of birth in the barns. Sweet world, think not to confuse me with poems or love beginning without a sign or sound. Here at the edge of rivers hung with ice, spring is still miles away, and yet I wake throughout the dark, listen, and throb with all her summoning explosions underground. Mm-mm. Our song today is a beloved American folk song, and there are about 3 different interpretations of what the lyrics mean, but for our purposes today, we're going to go with the one that links it to a resonant place, the Shenandoah River in Virginia, sung by a man who is far out west. This is Paul Robeson singing Shenandoah. Was Shenandoah, sung by Paul Robeson. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please rate it at iTunes. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Join me next week when my guest will be Fritjof Capra, who will be telling us what a relational thinker Leonardo da Vinci really was. Yes! Till then, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.